On the Philosopher's Zone, can you really upload your mind?
As leaders in consciousness transfer technology, we have brought humanity into a new era, providing the brightest minds renewed life to fulfill their true potential.
From a film recently doing the rounds, Selfless, on the theme of uploading your mind, it's an idea gaining traction. But can you spot the problem? Philosopher of mind, Max Capuccio, reckons he can. In fact, he says you'd better be certain of your assumptions before you throw the switch. Capuccio sees two fiercely competing theories in a fight to the death. One says that you can upload all the contents of your mind because there are contents and they're in your mind. And the other theory, well, let's just say that it's a mind half empty. It's not just a cool thought experiment either, because the consequences have real-world effects, as we'll hear later, from robotics and AI to the sporting field.
Today there are people who really think this idea is plausible and that by means of technological developments we will soon be capable to transfer our mind on a computer and therefore achieve some kind of immortality. But then, of course, this requires that our mind is compatible with a computational device, so that the nature of our mind is itself computational, or at least offers some of the basic features that would allow to be emulated by a computer. And that's exactly what we call representational content.
So going back to the assumption that in a popular sense most people hold that somehow you might be able to upload your mind, that popular assumption is based on a computational version of the mind? Is that what's happening?
Yes, basically yes. The problem, I think, is not so much with this theory, the computational theory of mind, but on a particular kind of assumption that we have to buy into if we want to actually believe that the mind is uploadable. So basically here the issue is that when I want to upload my mind to a computer, I'm not just interested in having a replica or a duplicate of my mind, but I want that it's exactly my mind that is transferred into the computer, because of course that's my main interest. I want to become immortal. I don't just want to have a clone that is reproduced in that computer, right? But so that means that this function, this algorithm, should not only be qualitatively identical to the original, it should be also numerically identical, which means it's one and the same with the original thing. Now, there is a little problem with that. In order to maintain, to keep the numerical identity, we must have to deal with something that is individuated. Aristotle stated this principle of individuation, right? Which says that something can have an individual identity only if it is material, only if it has material accidents. So, for example, okay, this glass of water is just has its own identity because it has these material contingent qualities and properties. But let's say that I'm thinking of the Pythagoras theorem, right? And then you also are thinking of Pythagoras theorem. Is it just one and the same? Or is just two tokens of the same type? It's pretty much impossible to answer this question because there is no way simply to tell whether abstract immaterial entities are one and the same or are they're two different things, right? So, and the same thing is happens, of course, with the algorithms and with these operations, because these operations, they're not real objects, but they are relationships between objects or qualities or properties, but they're not real things in themselves, right? So if we say that we want to transfer our minds and we also buy into the idea that minds are algorithms or are these logical relationships and connections, right? Then basically we have to face this problem. So basically it's like if we want to have the cake and eat it too, right? Because on the one end, we are saying that the minds are immaterial. And this is a requirement of mind upload, because if minds were anything material, then basically we couldn't leave our bodies, we couldn't abandon our body and gain what transhumanists called this kind of liberation from the body, right? On the other hand, if we want to keep numerical identity, we must have something that preserves this principle of individuation that is absolutely necessary, at least from the point of view of Aristotle, Aristotelian metaphysics, which says that nothing can be exactly one and the same unless it is something material, something that is embedded into material circumstances and accidents and contingencies, right? So we want our mind to be something that could be free from material accidents, but at the same time, we want our minds to be something that is individually identical to itself. I think that the only way to preserve both conditions, to be consistent with both these constraints, is to postulate the idea that there is metaphysical immaterial entity, which is exactly representational content, which is just a pure system of logical relationships that exist in some immaterial domain, and it's real, has causal power, has its own identity, but at the same time does not have any of these material accidents and is not subject to contingencies and so on and so forth. This is a very problematic idea.
Does it go against Aristotle's original metaphysics on this by doing that? By saying because you don't have your material accidents, as you say?
Absolutely, yes, yes. Actually, maybe this sounds more a sort of Platonic kind of metaphysics. Maybe not even Plato did really endorse this kind of metaphysics. It's very complicated to tell whether Plato really believed in this or not, but at least it's a Platonist idea.
Platonist idea. Yes. Is it Cartesian to some degree too, because there's a separation?
Definitely. This is a sort of Cartesian dualism, in the sense that we are postulating that the mind is not just a function or a principle of organization of the matter, but it's something, is a substance that exists in itself and by itself independently of the body.
So what's the problem with that? It's such a popular view, isn't it? There's a very popular belief that this is possible.
Right, and in a sense it's also embedded in our common sense, or at least for many people it's commonsensical. But there is a little issue with that if we want to provide a purely scientific account of the mind, our approach to be enlightened by the basic principles of cognitive science, then we have to endorse a naturalistic point of view. Then we cannot mix natural and supernatural entities, right? We cannot use supernatural principles in order to explain how natural phenomena work.
But maybe there's a belief in this because the subpart of this is identity. The numerical part relates to the fact that I want to be me when I'm uploaded to wherever I'm uploaded. So that is my memories, my psychological continuity, my sense of myself, the things that make me are still there and are numerically equivalent to me now here.
I would try to put the question this way. Can you imagine to be still yourself if you abandon completely all the properties, qualities that characterize you as yourself? So if you don't have a body anymore, and so what are these pure memories, for example, that we are talking about, but they are not implemented into any bodily circumstances? So is it still possible to think that we are ourselves if we're not anymore incarnated?
Can I take you back to something you said before? You've used an example of an email, sending an email as a way of explaining what the issue might be. Tell me about that example.
Yes, that's another example to explain that numerical identity can only belong to something that is materially instantiated. So, okay, if I send a letter written on paper, right, then I know exactly what it means, that it moves from a point X to a point Y in space. Because it is a physical object which is exists in the extended space, right? If I say that the meaning of that letter moves from point X to point Y, am I really saying something correct? Probably not. Probably there is a categorical mistake here, because we're assuming that something immaterial, non-extended, non-spatial, can actually change or move exactly like a physical object, a material object would do. Again, we're doing a mix of two different things, right? So we are mixing material properties, material phenomena with non-physical, non-extended objects and phenomena.
So what is that non-extended, non-physical object or phenomena, this immaterial thing? Because this is the thing that gets us into the mess, doesn't it?
Right. Okay, so I want to say one thing. According to classical functionalism and the principle of multiple realizability. The theorists, they never needed to distinguish between preserving only the qualitative identity and whether the numerical identity is preserved or not, right? Because basically, when you want to replicate a cognitive function, such as the algorithm that the software in a computer, you don't ask yourself whether it is exactly one the same or just a system of operations that do the same. No? What you really care about is that the system is producing the same output once every time you introduce the same input, right? So the question of whether there is numerical identity in the process or not, that has never been addressed. Now, with the example of Mind Upload, it becomes a central question because that bunch of information, that bunch of algorithms is you, right? So you want that it's exactly not just the same in the sense that it works in the same way or produces the same outcome, but you want it to be exactly you. So I think even if it's just speculation, this thought experiment, mind uploading, can help us to address this kind of questions.
Mm. So there's another theory, isn't there? The REC theory, the radically inactive cognition theory. Tell me what that tells us and how it might help in this particular situation, if mind upload is a bit of an issue.
Yeah, definitely. I think that mind upload and this particular approach to cognition that we call the REC, radically inactive approach to cognition, or radically inactive and embodied cognition, I believe they are arch enemies. They are two opposite points of view and they exclude one another. Mind upload requires that our minds are basically made out of contentful representation, while this idea is exactly what REC excludes, right? The radically inactive approach to cognition says that basic minds cannot have and don't need representational contents. So these kind of representations are not among the basic constituents of our mind. That doesn't mean that representations don't exist at all. There are representations, but mainly they exist, they operate in the socio-cultural domain, in the linguistic domain. So they are products of our social practices and communication capabilities.
They extend from the mind.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. And so basically we cannot attribute this kind of representational functions to the basic functioning of our brains, right? So if you examine neuron synapses and the way they work, it doesn't matter how much you go into the detail of the processes, you will never find anything like contents and like representation. While it absolutely makes sense to speak about, to talk about representations when we're talking about a work of art, a story being narrated, a book and so on, right? A novel. That's a representation of our life. That's a specific place in which representations exist. So mind upload, in a sense, you can consider a sort of a stress test to test how solid our belief in representations is. Exactly because in order to upload your mind, you would need that your mind is made out of representations. So, for example, David Chalmers, he wrote, the biggest question about mind upload is that we want to know whether we would survive. Once we undergo the mind upload process, then I will ask myself, but will I survive this process or not? So is it going to be still me after the process, that kind of digital me? Is it really me or actually I've been killed in the process, right? Then we can change this question and we can give a different formulation to this question and we can ask, is your belief in the representational theory of mind so solid that you would undergo this mind upload process? Or you would have some doubts. If you have any doubt, then it's better you don't do it because you can never be sure that the person, the software coming out at the end of the pipeline would be exactly you again.
Mm. So if you're a believer of radical inactive cognition, you wouldn't really push the button, would you?
Definitely not.
Mm, because you don't believe that those contents are going to be
numerically you. You don't believe that basic minds are made out of contentful representations. Therefore, you don't think that there is anything that could ever be uploaded through this mind upload process.
So is the punchline here that we're moving towards looking at the world through, say, phenomenological eyes or through the eyes of, say, a Heideggerian approach where there is being in the world and you are somehow connected to the world?
Oh yeah, definitely. That's the kind of perspective that can enlighten a different insight about this problem.
This has ramifications and consequences for everything from artificial intelligence to robotics to how to play sport well. I mean, it's quite a wide arc, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes, you're absolutely right. Mm. This approach to artificial intelligence, inspired by Heideggerian phenomenology, and in which, of course, the role of played by the body and our incarnated situation is key. In that, the root of intelligence is in something else. It is in this immediate responsiveness and capability to adapt. It's a sort of adaptivity to the world. And this adaptivity cannot exist if you're not embodied, if you're not situated in real-life contingencies. So this has consequences also for the way to understand the research in artificial intelligence. So instead of dreaming to build human-like intelligence, we have to go through different kind of research that starts really from the foundation, from the building blocks, and therefore how can we use this knowledge then to have artificial intelligence.
And we'll talk to someone about that in just a moment. Max Cappuccio lectures in philosophy at the United Arab Emirates University. This is the Philosopher's Zone on RN.
Well, what I'm really interested in is the origins of intelligence, the evolutionary process. I don't tell this to the philosophers, but I'm attacking the same problems that philosophers have been attacking, but doing it with another methodology.
Luke Steels builds robots for a living. In fact, he's one of the world's leading robotics researchers. These days, he's getting them to talk to each other, and in the process is putting into practice this rethink that Max talked about. How mind is perhaps not where we think it is. It all started with some early work with two electronic tortoises, Elmer and Elsie, pitted against each other for scarce resources. The results were eye-opening.
One experiment which totally surprised me was that we started these robots with equal, the same program, right? So they had some way to know when to go to the charging station, whether they could do more work, to learn about their environment, to navigate around. And so we had a population of robots doing this and everything was going well. And then at some point we noticed that some of these robots became kind of masters of the other robots in the sense that they worked much, much less. They did much less box pushing than these other robots, which sort of were enslaved to do more work. And so we didn't put in any of this division of labor, you know, this kind of social inequality, you might say. But nevertheless, this kind of phenomenon emerged in this population. And so it turned out that after analysis that it's actually due to the dynamics of the whole situation and the unavoidable randomness. A couple of lessons in this experiment. One of them is that indeed people were visiting this experiment and they were saying, oh, look at this nasty robot. It's pushing another robot out of the charging station, you know, do something, right? And so we ascribe all sorts of intentionalities and, you know, people think these robots are conscious in some way. But we know, of course, we didn't put any of this kind of stuff in it. In fact, the learning mechanism is very simple. So there's just one parameter, if you want, which is changing inside the program, which the robot itself can change. And so it is increasing or decreasing that parameter based on its experience with the environment. So this is, I think, a major important point. The complexity that we see is not due to complexity in the brains of these robots, but it is actually due to the interaction between simple behaviors in interaction with the environment and in interaction with the other robots.
So let's fast forward now to the work you're doing with environments, adaptation to those environments, and the emergence of complexity in those environments, now adding language.
Yeah, exactly. So when, these early studies were already motivated by the need to understand the origins of complex behavior, right? And so in contrast to, let's say, earlier work in AI, which put in a lot of complexity in the agents, I was always trying to see, make it more simple and see how with simple elements we can build up. Now, the criticism that came, which I think is partly justified, is to say, okay, these robots, they do obstacle avoidance, you know, they go around in these ecosystems. But what about real intelligence, right? You could say that the top of intelligence is really that we can communicate in natural language, I mean, or in a symbolic way. We can formulate very abstract thoughts and things like that. And the question is, how could that arise? And this is how I then came back to my interest in language and trying to understand how complex language could arise, again, not by programming it, but by finding out what are the fundamental mechanisms that allow the emergence of language by interaction with others and interaction with the environment.
So is language now emerging? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I would say that there are forms of language that we have demonstrated without any doubt that can emerge in such populations of robots. So the concepts that these robots are expressing, they're also built up by themselves, you know, by learning mechanisms, by interaction with the environment and with others. And so one example experiment is about color, how color terms might arise. Another experiment is about space, how concepts like left and right and front and back might emerge. And so in the beginning, it was a lot about how lexicons could come about. You know, first lexicons with a few words, but at the moment it's very much about how syntax may arise and how grammar can come about. And also here, I think we have fantastic results and really very interesting stuff.
So you're seeing grammar evolve. You're watching adaptive, complex system of language evolving and coming out through the interactions of the robots.
Yes.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, exactly. It's been incredibly exciting time.
What strikes me is the intersubjectivity or the relationality or the fact that could be possibly saying something about the nature of the human world.
Yeah, absolutely. The social element in the sense of interacting with others is absolutely crucial for the bootstrapping, you know, the emergence of complexity in the conceptual domain and in the language domain.
How much is the embodiment of the robot in all of this?
Well, the embodiment is really crucial, and that's why we do experiments with real robots. You could do a lot with simulation and you can think about it, but actually the real challenge is to show that language is emerging out of embodied interactions between these agents. So why is it so important? Well, for example, just take space, okay, to talk about space. So left and right and front and back only make sense when you have a body which has a particular orientation. Your sensory inputs, right, that you get from your vision system and from the interaction with the environment are the foundation on which you build concepts. And so these concepts and therefore the language have to be grounded in the bodily interaction with the world. So I really do think that embodiment and embodied interaction is really where we have to start. You know, it's not the end result, right? Language doesn't fall out of the sky, out of nothing. It actually comes out of our embodied interaction with the world and with others.
It seems to me you could be solving some very large philosophical chestnuts in those robotics laboratories.
Yeah, I think this is like experimental philosophy, you know. I don't tell this to the philosophers, but I'm attacking the same problems that philosophers have been attacking, but doing it with another methodology.
Yes, and as it turns out, we could all be out of our minds. Via Skype, Luke Steels on the trail of the evolution of intelligence and what it might say about mind, language, embodiment, and the self. He's director of the Artificial Intelligence Lab at the University of Brussels, and his work on robots and language is pretty stunning. Details on our site. Where you're most welcome to listen again, download, read more, and browse the archive. Production today by Martin Peralta. I'm Joe Gelonesi. Hope to see you next week here in The Zone.